From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. He's broadcasting from home. I'm Kojo Nandi. So am I. Well, today the conversation is all about upcoming elections in this region, the District, Maryland, and Virginia. So if you've got questions or comments about elections here, then we have the people who can answer those questions. You can start calling now. Our in-house expert, our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper is Tom Sherwood. Tom, welcome.
Hello, everyone.
And later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Larry Sabato, the director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, Jenna Portnoy, regional politics reporter for the Washington Post, and Danielle Gaines, reporter for Maryland Matters. But we're taking your calls from right now if you're calling about any upcoming election. Joining us now is Martin Ostermule. He's a politics reporter for WAMU. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Coach. I appreciate it.
Martin, politics seem to have taken a backseat during the coronavirus, but D.C. is still scheduled to have its primary in June. Can you remind us what will be on the ballot?
Right. So it's going to be lots of local seats. I mean, there's ward-based seats on the D.C. Council. Ward 2 is up. Ward 4 is up. Ward 7 and 8 are up. There's also the presidential primary at this point. It doesn't seem like there's going to be a whole lot of competition there, but still it's on the ballot. The U.S. delegate to Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, is going to be on, a shadow senator and a shadow representative. So it's a fairly wide range of seats that are going to be up for the primary.
This week, the ACLU for D.C. hosted virtual forums for candidates in Ward 2 and 4, focusing on criminal justice. I know Tom Sherwood watched Ward 2. I watched Ward 4, but you probably watched them both. So let's start with Ward 2, which is a crowded race. Who are the candidates to watch?
Well, I mean, that's a really tough one. Now, obviously, Jack Evans, who resigned his seat in January before he could be expelled by his colleagues for ethical misconduct, he's running to take back his seat. He's running against a relatively crowded field. Tom could probably remind me if it's 7 or 8 challengers, but it's a lot of people. And it's all over the place. At this point, the numbers would tell you that Jack Evans could squeak by because there's a pretty divided field of challengers against him, and people know who he is. And he's been on something of an apology tour. He published a letter, I think it was in the Georgetown or another local publication, essentially saying, I broke the rules, I'm sorry, give me another chance.
Tom Sherwood.
That's right. There are 7 challengers wanting to take over the seat from Jack Evans. But Joe, this is a weird campaign in that people cannot go door knocking. They can't have meet and greets. I've talked to several of the candidates about how they're trying to online get people to know them. Well, people do know Jack Evans. And while many people active know all the ethics issue he has, he's been in that seat for 30-something years, or close to 30 years, and there are a lot of people who know him and didn't like what he did, but still like him. And given the financial crisis that the district is in, like every other jurisdiction, they think he has the knowledge to play a role on the council should he get back on. But it's in a very aggressive race. Patrick Kennedy's an ANC, a longtime ANC member who's gotten a lot of support. It's a wide-open race at this point.
Martin Ostermule in the... by the way, Tom Sherwood, you watched the Ward 2 candidates forum. Anything stand out in particular to you?
Well, I actually listened to it more than I watched it. After a while, you get tired of looking at the screen. But, you know, I thought that Evans, because there was not a live crowd that heckled him like we did at the Logan Circle and DuPont Circle Association that we monitored, there was no one to heckle Jack Evans. He was able to speak freely and on time about the issues. But all the candidates acquitted themselves well. The problem was only about 180 people, I think, signed on to the online debate. So not a lot of people heard them.
Well, the reason there were no hecklers at the debate that Tom Sherwood and I moderated was because of, well, Tom Sherwood. Shall I say anything more? Martin, in the Ward 4 forum, one big guest was absent. The current Ward 4 council member, Brandon Todd. What should we know about the Ward 4 race?
It's competitive. It's interesting. I mean, Brandon Todd, he took over for Muriel Bowser, who is now the mayor of the District of Columbia. He's a close ally of the mayor's. Some would say he basically never breaks with the mayor. He's the mayor's go-to person on the council, probably one of the only remaining. generally speaking, I'd say well-liked, has raised a lot of money, is known across the ward as a constituent services sort of guy. He's the sort of guy that'll get the potholes filled and the trash picked up and that sort of stuff. But he's also been criticized for his lack of substance on legislative issues, that he's not addressing things like an uptick in crime and that sort of stuff. And now, during the course of this campaign, he's been, to a certain degree, absentee. Now, of course, everything has changed because nothing is being done in person, but I mean, he just hasn't been responding to questionnaires from different groups. He hasn't been appearing at events and things of that nature. And people are starting to say, like, where is Councilmember Todd? And that's giving Janice Lewis-George, one of his main competitors, a boost. And she's gotten a chunk of money from the public financing program that the district is running. She just released an online kind of TV ad of sorts this week that kind of told her story in glowing terms. So I'd say she's a pretty strong competitor at this point.
Well, I live in Ward 4, and Brandon Todd was the Constituent Services Director for Muriel Bowser when she was the council member here, and he does have a reputation for delivering on constituent services. One remembers a prior council member who had the same reputation, a guy named Adrian Fenty, who went on to become mayor and then kind of disappeared and could not win re-election. But I watched the forum, the Ward 4 forum the other night, and Brandon Todd's absence was glaring as a result. The other two candidates really didn't have anybody that they could really point a finger at and critique in any way. And I think that took something away from the interest in the Ward 4 forum itself. We'll have to see how it will go on. But of course, Brandon Todd has raised quite a bit of money, Tom Sherwood, and that could be one of the reasons why he may not feel the necessity to participate in these forums. But meanwhile, Janice Lewis-George has had, and we talked about this briefly last week, about all of the signs that were stolen, that were taken from her by, of all places, the Department of Public Works, Tom Sherwood.
Oh, that's true. That's been a spat within this campaign. I want to point out about Brandon Todd not attending forums, or the most recent one. You know, that's the playbook that Muriel Bowser had. Remember when she ran for mayor the second time and David Catania was the candidate against her? No, she declined to appear at a bunch of forums. And, you know, if you're the incumbent, if you have the mailing list and the email list of thousands of people that you've helped or at least corresponded with over a period of time, why do you want to go somewhere and give your opponents a chance to take pot shots at you? So this is not... It's a strategy by Brandon Todd to say, look, I'm going to focus on the people who know me in my ward, and that's all I'm going to care about to get through this election.
Martin Ostermo, Ward 7 council member and former D.C. Mayor Vincent Gray, is facing challenges for his seat. Any chance he could be unseated?
Again, Ward 7 is a tough one. I mean, it's an active campaign. I would never say that there isn't a chance that an incumbent can be beat, because it's happened in the past. But at the same time, it's a divided field that's running against the council member. He, generally speaking, his campaign will say that he's polling well. He's still popular in the ward. He's still out and about. He's well known. And yeah, again, I think, and Tom can speak to this too, I just feel like this pandemic has upended everything. I mean, at the end of the day, so much of these campaigns is that face-to-face interaction, the knocking on the doors, the going to events, the handing out flyers, especially as the weather warms up. I mean, that's bread and butter of local campaigning. And right now, everything is happening via Zoom. And look, we all love Zoom for its flexibility and it being just there for you to use on your phone or your computer. But at the same time, it has technical problems. It's kind of awkward. And it's not really a good way to convince an undecided voter that they should vote for you.
Trying to unseat Vincent Gray are Kelvin Brown, Anthony Lorenzo Green, Vida Rashid, and James Jennings. Tom Sherwood.
Yes, I'm sorry. I was taking a note there just when you tossed it to me. I want to point out that all the incumbents, the virus is a friend of incumbents because, again, it hampers all the candidates who are trying to unseat. And I think you asked me about Ward 8. I apologize. I got distracted for a moment.
Well, no, we haven't gotten to Ward 8 yet. We were just talking about Ward 7. I knew the council member who preceded Vincent Gray, Yvette Alexander, at one point I thought she was thinking of running again, but that's out the door, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. She did not run. You know, Vince Gray has, you know, he served as mayor. He was council chairman. He was on the council. He's on the council now. It's very difficult in a what I would call a normal election to unseat an incumbent. So, and as Martin just said, it has been done, but it has not been done very often.
Martin, Trayon White, the Ward 8 council member, is also facing challenges. What's happening there?
Well, I mean, this is, I think it's one of the most fascinating races to watch. Generally speaking, Ward 8 politics is seemingly a minefield. I mean, it just, alliances come and go, like people who are once, who once worked together no longer work together. And that's the case now. I mean, Tran White is being challenged by people who used to work with him, who campaigned with him, who led his campaigns.
Yep.
But Tran White is also, he is, I think Mitch Riles from the City Paper wrote it well this week when he said he's basically campaigning via Instagram and Facebook. He's very active on social media. He's out and about in the community. He's giving out food as part of mutual aid efforts. Like, he's very much doing the work of a council member, but he's also, he's putting it out there over social media in a way that none of his challengers can compete against. And that's going to be a tough one again. I mean, you see this guy out and about as much as he is, and his challengers are just trying to get their names out there.
Tom Sherwood, now we're on Ward 8.
Okay, well, yes, we're on Ward 8, but I want to move on.
good. Then let's move on.
but the issue is, who's going to vote? I am very worried. I called into the mayor's press conference Thursday, yesterday, because I have been looking at the plans for people to vote. It's hard enough to get people to vote, but in this case, with the virus backdrop, in order that mayors and the city is encouraging everyone to vote absentee. In order to do that, you must request a ballot. The city is not, for a variety of reasons, simply sending a ballot to registered voters. You, one, have to request a ballot. Two, the Board of Elections has to send you the ballot. Three, you have to fill out the ballot. And four, you have to return the ballot by the deadline of Election Day. My concern is that thousands and thousands of people who are not either internet savvy or don't even understand the process are not going to even get a ballot, much less return one. I'd like to hear Martin from this. I did talk to Tommy Wells. He's the former Ward 6 council member, but has been the director of environment and energy for Mayor Bowser. Mayor Bowser put him in charge of a committee to help the Board of Elections, an independent agency, make certain that it's ready to go. But just this week, the Board of Elections put out on Twitter a notice that it was having problems sending email notices to people that they are, in fact, registered to get a ballot. And there has been no publicity campaign yet. Councilmember Charles Allen, who oversees the Board of Elections, says they're not doing a publicity campaign yet. We'll do one in May once they have all the kinks worked out in the election process. But I'm just concerned in the weeks ahead, people are not going to know either to get an absentee ballot or how to get a ballot.
Indeed, we are in a situation that is very confusing, and having heard Tom Sherwood describe it, it's confusing to just about everyone. We'll have to see how that is working out. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll look at Maryland, but first, Martin Ostermule will tell us about a measure having to do with magic mushrooms. I'm Kojo Nand.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picoult and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back to the Politics Hour. We're talking about elections coming up in this region, in the district, Maryland and Virginia, and taking your calls at 800-433-8850. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. We'll also talk with Martin Ostermule, who's a politics reporter for WAMU. Before we move on to Maryland, Martin Ostermule, among the ballot measures is one having to do with magic mushrooms. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's a ballot
and
measure
DC, that...
that
is, yeah.
It's in the district. It's a ballot measure that, if passed by voters, it would basically lower the level of kind of enforcement that police does of use and possession of both magic mushrooms and psychedelic plants. This is being backed by the same group of folks that legalized marijuana at the ballot box in 2014. They got approval to start circulating petitions back in February, and the process is they have to collect signatures from 5% of the city's registered voters. That's about 25,000 voters. Now, imagine they get the permission to move forward in February, and basically 2 weeks later, the pandemic hits, and they have to call everything off because there's nothing worse than, I mean, there's no worse idea than circulating petitions, going door to door, handing people a pen that other people are using to sign petitions in the middle of a pandemic. So they're kind of stuck now, and they have their petitions in hand. They have 6 months to gather these signatures. They want to get on the November ballot, but they have no means to collect tens of thousands of signatures. So they've been, they say they're now going to mail petitions to voters through the district. So you may suddenly get something in the mail asking you to sign a petition for this ballot initiative. They've asked the city council to do something about it. I mean, they got stuck in a pretty bad situation that there's just not much that can be done quickly to address the fact that the normal way of gathering signatures has just been thrown out the window and there's not an alternative in place.
Time for the mushrooms to produce some magic. Joining us now is Danielle Gaines, a reporter for Maryland Matters. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for having me.
Danielle, the first election coming up during this public health crisis is in Maryland, April 28th. That's the special election to fill the late Congressman Elijah Cummings' seat in the 7th District. How is the state handling that election given stay-at-home orders and social distancing?
That election is going to be handled largely by mail, and it's already ongoing, actually. So ballots were sent out recently to about 484,000 residents in that district. 77,000 of them have been returned. Voters will have until Tuesday to return those ballots. The mail ballots need to be postmarked by Tuesday, so people should pay close attention to when they're dropping them off. There are drop-off locations available on Tuesday, and a very limited number of voters are going to be allowed to go to three voting locations in the state.
Former U.S. Congressman Kwesi Mfumi is the Democratic nominee for the special election. Is he expected to win next week?
He is expected to win. It's a heavily Democratic district, 4-1 Democratic advantage in registration. No Republican has ever represented the district, but there is a Republican candidate, Kim Klasick, who's a member of the Baltimore County Republican Central Committee.
And Tom Sherwood, Kwesi Mfumi is a well-known name because he held the seat previously.
Yes, he's a veteran politician. He ran the NAACP. There's been some criticism about that and how he left that organization. But he was a veteran member of Congress. He's well-liked mostly by the public. So that will play well for him in this election. I would like to ask Danielle, though, the Maryland just mailed out the ballot, and people need to mail them back in. But the response rate is still pretty low at this point. Do they expect just a sea of flood of ballots that we get next to Election Day? It's next week?
I don't know, but the state board has adopted policies to kind of help the local offices if they do, start seeing tens of thousands of ballots arriving in a single day. They've kind of loosened some policies about how the ballots have to be stamped as they come in, and instead they need to be archived in special bins and stuff like that, just to try to help them, handle this. And it's really three county boards of elections that are the testing grounds for this on next Tuesday. And then in June, the whole state will be undergoing it. So there's going to be a really quick turnaround between, figuring out policies that work next week and trying to make them better by June.
Yeah, okay. One of the questions I have, that's Howard County, Baltimore County, Baltimore City. But for those of us in the media and people who want to know, on election night, are we going to know who won, or will there be, because they'll have to count ballots that come in on election day, I would guess. So will we know the results election night?
Definitely not the full results, but the state has changed a policy to allow local boards of elections to start processing ballots before election day. And any results that are processed before election day have to, the results will be embargoed until that night. So on election night, we may see some initial numbers from these districts. So far, about 16% of ballots have been returned in the 7th district.
Danielle, Maryland has delayed its regular primary until June 2nd. What decisions have been made about that election?
So the June 2nd primary is also going to be largely by mail. People are being encouraged to vote by mail. Every active registered voter is going to get a ballot in the mail. It'll be postage prepaid, so you need to fill it out, send it back. Counties are going to have collection sites. The state is in the process of creating some heavy-duty security bins where ballot drop-off will be available. And then, again, on June 2nd, there will be a very limited number of places where people can go and vote in person if they can't vote by mail for one reason or another. If they didn't receive a ballot or if they have a disability where they would be helped by using a ballot marking device in person. And counties, each county will have between 1 and 4 voting centers on Election Day.
Okay, let's get back into D.C. for a minute because we have a call from one Jordan Grossman who happens to be a candidate in Ward 2. Jordan Grossman, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to say in response to your discussion, we've actually spoken to thousands of Ward 2 voters since the coronavirus pandemic, and we hear over and over again that people want a clean break from Jack Evans and his corruption. And I also just wanted to note that we have broad support from many D.C. local leaders like Councilmember Alyssa Silverman. And just this week, we got endorsed by the D.C. Metro Labor Council that represents thousands of union members in D.C. So we feel really strongly that we need a clean break from Jack Evans, and that's what Ward 2 is going to do in this election.
Jordan Grossman using the royal we. Martin Ostermuhl, Patrick Kennedy, I think, is might be ahead of Jordan Grossman, at least according to Patrick Kennedy's poll. But care to comment?
I mean, no, it's a fair point. I think obviously every campaign at this point is going to say, listen, we're out there. People want to break from Evans, which is I'm sure is very true for many voters. But at the end of the day, it only matters what happens on Election Day. And I think, again, I found it fascinating that a couple months ago, the Washington Post did a poll about the situation Evans was facing. And there was a huge amount of people that just didn't know what was going on or barely knew who Evans was. And that's the dynamic of the race, is that if you just don't pay attention to local politics, you this may be noise to you. So when it comes to going on Election Day, you may look at the ballot and be like, oh yeah, that guy, I remember his name, I'll vote for him. So the challenge is trying to get over that and trying to convince people like, look, he did this, this was wrong, you should throw him out of office for these reasons.
Tom Sherwood, at least Jordan Grossman is listening. Does he get points for that?
Yes, he gets. Anyone who listens gets points as long as they don't talk too much. I will ask Jordan, though. I don't want him to talk about who's endorsed him or not because we don't have the other candidates on. But I would ask him, he says he's contacting thousands of voters. How are you doing that? I know I looked at your finance campaign and you have a lot of support and money-wise. Most of it, though, is outside of Ward 2 and you're still getting yourself known in the ward. How are you reaching out to these voters? Are you doing mailings that I haven't seen yet or phone calls? What are you doing?
Yeah, sort of all of the above. And, you know, we do have the most D.C. resident donors of any candidate in Ward 2, and we've had that throughout the campaign, $50 or less
citywide.
In the fair elections.
Public financing. Let's be clear, that's citywide, not Ward 2.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But in terms of how we're reaching people, in terms of how we're reaching people, you know, we always just try to reach people where they are. So we're texting them, we're calling them, we're mailing them. We're doing, as you mentioned, the ACLU forum. I've done virtual events and forums every night this week. And so, you know, instead of meeting folks at the Metro or at their door, we're meeting folks on their phone and online and in their mailbox. It's not stopping us from talking to voters about what they need. And, you know, what I hear is people want to make sure, especially now more than ever, as we rebuild from the COVID crisis, that they can afford to stay here in neighborhoods that they love, especially if they've lost their job or they're struggling with their rent. We need to make that the number one focus, that we're going to focus on families and workers.
Martin Ostermuhl, in the 30 seconds we have left, we got a tweet from Pat. D.C. Board of Elections will not automatically provide absentee ballots to registered voters for the primary? You have to be kidding.
That's what's going on. I mean, they said it was going to be too complicated to go full vote by mail, but Maryland is proving it's not. And I think Maryland is getting some credit from other states that already do vote by mail. They've had the director of elections in Colorado said this week that he was really impressed that Maryland was literally just pulling the trigger and just trying.
In other words, Pat, we're not kidding. Going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking Virginia politics. I'm Coach Onandi. Welcome back. We're talking regional elections with Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst. Martin Ostermule is a politics reporter for WMU. Danielle Gaines is a reporter for Maryland Matters. And we're taking your calls as we move into discussing Virginia politics at 800-433-8850. We got an email from Elise who says, I've been a D.C. voter for 12 years now. Just this morning, I changed my party affiliation so I could vote for Janice against Brandon Todd, since I don't like how he blindly supports the mayor. I was a statehood Green Party member. And Doug tweets, there's going to be a lot of improvising between now and November. Hopefully, do it sooner rather than later so you can fight the court battles now. Joining us now is Jenna Portner, a regional politics reporter for The Washington Post. Jenna, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jenna, Virginia's primary elections were originally scheduled for June 9th, and Governor Ralph Northam delayed them by 2 weeks until June 23rd. What are the big races on that ballot?
That's right. Some of these unprecedented changes in elections affect some of the most competitive races in the state. So in addition to the June 9th primary that will now be June 23rd, there's been a big change to conventions. So instead of happening tomorrow, a couple of Republican conventions have until July 28th to pick their candidate. In terms of the primary, Elaine Luria is the incumbent down in Virginia Beach. And there are quite a few Republicans vying for her seat, including Scott Taylor, a former Navy SEAL who previously held the seat. She defeated him in a district won by President Trump. So that'll be very competitive. The other most competitive race is in the Richmond suburbs, where incumbent Abigail Spanberger is defending her seat against a handful. I mean, there's at least a half dozen Republicans, including two sitting delegates, state delegates, who want to challenge her. And their convention will be sometime in the next several months.
Tom Sherwood, what are you looking at there?
Well, I know that the governor, we are keeping the primary date, but he encouraged people or has encouraged or is encouraging people to vote by mail, but there's been no restriction on precincts to kind of force people to vote by mail. All the precincts will be open, as I understand it. Is that right, Jenna?
Absolutely. I just actually posed the question to the Board of Elections to see if that's true. But at this point, as far as I understand, there's no changes proposed to the polling places. There's a lot of potential challenges there. You know, a lot of poll workers are volunteers. They're retired folks who may not be too keen on going to potentially crowded polling places in the middle of the summer. So we'll see if that changes. But at this point, all those polling places are open. They are encouraging people to vote by mail. But at this point, there are no plans to send mass absentee ballots out unless, you know, folks apply for them on their own.
Let me ask you also about, there are local county level elections in May. The governor wanted to postpone those to November, throw out the ballots that had already been cast absentee and change that. But the Republicans in the legislature this week and some Democrats weren't comfortable throwing out ballots. So they have not changed the voting for May, which is coming right up. The governor is supposedly thinking about what he might do. Is there anything he can do without legislative support to delay the May elections?
Absolutely. He has a couple of options. I mean, he can call a special session. Again, that would rely on the legislature passing that bill. Or he believes he can delay the election for 2 weeks. Now, a May election delayed for 2 weeks may not make much of a difference as we're sort of at the height of this coronavirus pandemic. But you're right that the legislature controlled by Democrats did effectively kill that bill just yesterday.
Jenna, are there any elections in Northern Virginia that are scheduled for that May 5th date?
Fairfax City has a mayoral race that is relatively competitive. I talked to the mayor there, and he said, you know, he's really changing up the way he's campaigned. Instead of doing door-to-door, he's doing a lot of social media, a lot of virtual meetings. Direct mail has been a big strategy for him, so we'll see what happens. Those elections tend to have such a low turnout because they're in smaller localities. It'll be interesting to see how this is affected.
Here's Rob in Alexandria, Virginia. Rob, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Hi, Kojo. Hey, Tom. Hey, thank you for allowing me to call in, take my call. My question is, you know, I'm very happy with the gun control legislation. that was signed, and I was at the Navy Yard during the shooting back before I retired, and you know, still have nightmares about that day. But so my question for your commentator is, do you foresee any backlash, grassroots, things that could cause trouble? Well, to me, it's trouble that could sweep back in a Republican majority into the politics of Virginia. Thank you.
Jenna Portnoy?
So far, we don't have any indication of that. There haven't been many polls yet. But at this point, at least at the congressional level, you know, there are a couple competitive races, and we'll see what happens there. There have been a couple small protests outside the Capitol of Northam, the Capitol in Richmond, when it comes to you know, his social distancing measures and his emergency orders. But it appears across the state people are abiding by them, you know, generally.
Jenna, Republican candidates for Congress are selected by convention instead of by a primary. Can you explain how that process works, and will it change because of the pandemic?
So Virginia is really interesting in that respect. Depending on how the party decides, they could nominate candidates by state-run primary or by party-run convention. So in all these cases, the virus has given these candidates some more time to campaign, to woo their voters. Republicans see that, you know, as a positive. They have more time to get their message across. However, it doesn't give them as much time then to focus on the Democrat when it comes to the general election. So in the primary down in Virginia Beach, you have Scott Taylor and you have Ben Loyola. They are locked in a pretty competitive race against hoping to vie against Congresswoman Luria. That'll be June 23rd. And then the convention for the Republican to compete against Spamberger was supposed to be held tomorrow. Certainly isn't happening. It was going to be in the Arthur Ashe Athletic Center. That's called off. They have until July 28th to figure out where to have that. They can't do it at the Arthur Ashe Center anymore because it has no air conditioning. So the whole process is thrown into uncharted territory here.
Tom Sherwood, we got this email from Todd in Virginia. I don't know if you've been following this. Why does nobody challenge President Trump's disinformation on vote by mail? Only one ballot per registered voter at each address. If a second ballot from that address with the same name is received, it would immediately raise a red flag for investigation. To be sure, absentee ballot harvesting, as Republicans did in North Carolina in 2018, could facilitate fraud, but it's easy to prevent. Just provide prepaid return envelopes like Washington State. Know anything about that at all, Tom Sherwood?
Well, I know that everyone, because of the virus, are trying to figure out a way to get people to vote, and the district chose not to because it just did not think it had the technical ability to just send out 400,000 plus ballots with return stamps on them. And so I think it's a problem. There's very little strong evidence of vote. There's very little evidence of voter fraud in this country, but given the haphazard nature of this virus disrupted campaign season, people are worried that the ballots will not be properly treated. I did want to point out to Rob from, I think it was from Alexandria, who called in. One thing about the Republicans gaining any new foothold is there are no state legislative races. The House and the Senate, there are no races this year for the House and Senate. And if I could ask Jenna, the ghost campaign of this year really seems to be Mark Warner. 6 years ago, he came within a fraction of losing to a Republican, but that race seems to be getting zero attention. Is it because he has not much strong opposition?
That's a great question. I mean, I think he is seen as not nearly as vulnerable as he was last time around. Ed Gillespie mounted a very strong campaign against him. It was a great year for Republicans. It was certainly much closer than Senator Warner would have liked. But this year, he seems to be getting so far a bit of a free pass. You know, Republicans are fielding quite a few candidates to try to challenge him. But there's no clear indication that he has reason to worry. Neither of the parties are targeting the race. And, you know, he's had such a high profile as vice chairman of the Intelligence Committee. I think that's really helped solidify some of his support.
Got another caller who is a candidate in Washington, D.C. I guess you all know the name of Ed Lazier. Ed Lazier, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Great. Thanks so much for having me on, Kojo. So I heard you comment about the petition gathering process for ballot initiatives and wanted to be clear that there's also a big petition gathering challenge for people like me who are running as independent candidates who have to gather signatures over the summer, as well as anybody running for ANC or for State Board of Education. And those petitions are supposed to be gathered in June, July, and submitted in early August. And that's just going to be impossible. And so I am urging the mayor and council and sending a letter just today and putting on my campaign website. It's a bit of a crazy alternative, but we're in a crazy world, that instead of gathering petitions, which is unsafe for everybody, that we just allow candidates to collect small dollar donations, as little as $1, which many candidates are already doing under public financing. They're using small dollar donations to get public financing, that we use that as a threshold of support, which is really the key issue in getting on the ballot and petitions, is to show that you have some support. It's an existing mechanism that would allow people to get on the ballot while maintaining safety at this really important time.
Tom Sherwin?
Would that expand the field of the candidates? You're one. I think now there are 10, maybe 11 at-large candidates for the November election, for the one of the two seats at-large. Would your proposal make just crowd the ballot and maybe you'll have 20-something people like Montgomery County did for some of its at-large races?
It's a legitimate question. I actually don't think it will. I mean, I can tell you that getting donations is not an easy thing. And of the 12 people who are running, most of them are seeking public financing. And many of them haven't reached the threshold, which is 250 donors yet. So that's a sign to me that it's not easy. And that if anybody wants to jump in and run and think they can quickly get 250 donations, I don't really think that's true. So I don't know that it would greatly expand the number of people running for office, and certainly that was not my goal.
You're not on the ballot, Ed, for the primary, but you are for the fall. Are you concerned at all that the Board of Elections is doing enough to educate people on how you get a ballot and vote?
No. I mean, you know, I just sent a letter yesterday along with Janice Lewis-George and Jordan Grossman, you know, running in Ward 4 and Ward 2, to express our concerns that we don't know that they have a good enough plan to let people know how to get a ballot and that they aren't starting soon enough. So, no, I'm very nervous that the June primary will also be compromised.
Okay, Ed Lazare, thank you for your call. Just quickly, Danielle Gaines, the Maryland General Assembly was supposed to reconvene in May for a special session, but is that still going to happen given the pandemic?
No, it's not. The General Assembly, as you know, had to adjourn a couple of weeks early given the pandemic and announced plans that they wanted to come back in late May, potentially to take up unfinished business, potentially to take up overrides of gubernatorial vetoes. Late May is not looking like a good time to meet still given the coronavirus, and it's unclear whether or not there will be a special session later in the year or if the General Assembly would just take up these things come next January when they're scheduled to meet anyhow.
Joining us now is Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Larry Sabato, thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Larry Sabato, we got a tweet from Adam who said, we need voting by mail and online now so that Trump and his cult can't steal this election. Larry Sabato, as more states move to using vote by mail systems during this pandemic, could you see it becoming a more permanent fixture in more state voting systems?
Well, I certainly hope so. Look, many of us have been advocating for all mail balloting for many, many years. In fact, in my case, it's decades. This made sense 30 years ago. It makes far more sense today because of the pandemic. You know, I just retweeted an article that was produced by the Pew Trust. It was the original article by the Pew Trust looking at localities that use vote by mail. And what was interesting is the headline was GOP controlled counties love all mail voting. Quote, it's safe and easy. People love it. And all of this nonsense about it being hackable and it's inaccurate and people steal votes and it only helps Democrats. Just nonsense. Absolute nonsense. Do facts matter anywhere anymore? Do they? I wonder.
Martin Ostermill, you reported on this too, right? Oh, he seems to have lost Martin Ostermill.
No, sorry about that, Kojo. I am here.
Go ahead.
No, sorry. What was the question? I did miss the question, unfortunately.
Oh, we were talking about voting by mail becoming a more permanent fixture in many states. And
yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
It's the sort of thing that, I mean, this is, weirdly enough, the pandemic is probably the greatest thing that's happened to vote by mail advocates, because suddenly everybody is interested out of necessity. Now, the places in the region that could probably shift most quickly and are Maryland and D.C., mostly because they have no excuse absentee balloting, which Virginia is now going to do also. But again, I mean, this could be a boon if this turns out well this time around and people get used to it and say, hey, this is pretty convenient. You know, that might be the thing that tips the scales for the region to just say vote by mail is the way to go.
Tom Sherwood.
I would wonder, and I asked Larry Sabato. It's great talking to you again, Larry. I haven't talked to you for a while.
Tom, great to see you other than on Twitter.
Well, yeah, please follow at Tom Sherwood. There's a lot of talk about vote by mail, but, you know, we do so much online now. Do we have to get to vote by mail before we get to online voting? You know, I can file my taxes online. I can buy something from most any company online. I can do anything online. I'm identified. I pay. Do we have to do vote by mail? Why can't we do also vote by online?
Tom, I'm. Are you asking me?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, Tom.
You're the one who knows everything.
I'm a great advocate of technology, but not in this case. I actually agree with the critics on online voting. We aren't ready for that. And believe me, a lot is going to have to be developed to increase security before I would be happy with that. I'm in favor of regressing to pencil and paper, which is really what all mail voting is. And that's why I think we can trust it. And there are all kinds of reasonable safeguards that have been adopted by the five states that already have it, which includes, by the way, a very conservative Republican state of Utah, and they love it. Now, you know, it can be done. It can be done by November. It actually could be done sooner than that, but we need all of these days and weeks and months, and states ought to get busy on it now. But of course they're not, because one of the parties has decided that somehow this would elect only Democrats. Tell that to Utahns. That'd be very interesting. Only Democrats winning under all-mail balloting. No, it's really not true, is it? Utah has, except for one Democratic U.S. House member, it's a Republican state.
Well, President Trump, in between recommending Lysol for various activities and drugs he can't pronounce, has said that, well, you know, if we have this kind of mail voting, then the Republicans will never win again.
Yeah, that's what he said. And it's about as accurate as his recommendation to inject people with Clorox.
Larry Sabato, Virginia lawmakers decided to freeze much of their two-year spending plan as a response to the coronavirus pandemic. Do you think this freeze will put some Democratic priorities in jeopardy?
Well, they're already in jeopardy because unlike the federal government, the state can't print money. None of the states can print money. They wish they could, but they can't. And that's why they're pushing so hard to be included in the next round of grants from Washington, you know, the $1 trillion grants. I think it's $2.5 trillion or more that's been passed already. But no, they can't do it, and they have to live within their means. And that means delaying these priorities. It doesn't mean canceling them. I think eventually they'll come into phase. However, you know, but God forbid we could have that second wave and even a third wave. It's like the influenza epidemic in 1918, 1919. I hope we don't, but we have to consider the possibility. And if we do, it's going to be a while before we get the sorts of things like the increased minimum wage passed by the General Assembly a couple of months ago.
Jenna Portnoy, any questions for Larry Sabato?
And I'd love to know what he thinks about the midterm elections in general and how they might go, depending on all this this virus stuff.
Yeah, you mean this coming November?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I think we just issued a new survey of both the House and the Senate races. What's changed there is not so much the House. The House has been favored to stay Democratic all the way along. The only way the House could go Republican is if somehow this election breaks open in Trump's favor and he wins by such a large margin that he can pull Republicans in just enough districts to hit the magic 218. Is it possible? It's April. Of course it's possible, but it doesn't seem very likely. And right now, Democrats are leading or clearly ahead or secure in about 227 districts. You need 218 for a majority. And that allows for many toss-ups, that some of which would go Democratic. Now, the Senate is the interesting part of this. If you can go back 18 months, what did everybody say 18 months ago? Look at this map. There's no way Democrats can gain the number of seats they need. They're at 47. They have to gain 4 without the vice presidency and 3 if they manage to win the presidency and vice presidency. And they're automatically going to lose 1 seat in Alabama, that freakish result that gave Doug Jones the Senate seat 3 years ago. Well, things have changed. And in fact, even though Doug Jones is still very much in jeopardy, Maine with Susan Collins is an even bet now. Colorado is looking to oust its incumbent Republican Senator Cory Gardner, just a freshman, who will be very lucky to get a second term, and it doesn't look like he's going to get it. And you go around the country, even in Montana, which I doubt switches, but the private polls right now have the governor, Governor Bullock, who ran briefly for president, leading the incumbent Republican Senator Steve Daines. You have other highly competitive seats that weren't expected to be on the map but are. Arizona, the Democrat, Mark Kelly, the former astronaut, is actually leading the appointed incumbent, Martha McSally, by a considerable margin. Now, again, it's April. Loads of things can change by November, but Democrats actually have a shot at taking over the Senate.
Larry Sabato, Virginia Senator Mark Warner released a now viral video this week of him making a tuna melt. Frankly, that tuna melt was of questionable quality. But it's my understanding that you have a sandwich recipe, too.
Absolutely. I recommended it to Senator Warner, but he wasn't wise enough to accept it and put out that horrible tuna melt video, which was nauseating. And not just to people like me who are vegetarian, but I think to a broad base out there in the public. My recipe is one I think people will relate to. You take a piece of bread, you slather on peanut butter. It can be crunchy or smooth, depending on your taste. You take another piece of bread and you slather on jelly or jam. It can be grape, as I prefer, or strawberry, or apricot, as I got a suggestion on Twitter. And then you slap those two pieces of bread together, and it's got all the food groups virtually included in it. And you know what? If you're still hungry after eating that, it takes 1 minute to prepare another peanut butter and jelly sandwich. You get two of them.
You should patent that sandwich. No one has ever heard of one like it before.
Yes, no one's ever thought of that.
Very quickly, maybe you can answer Joe Webb in St. Mary's County, Maryland. Joe, you only have about 30 seconds. Go ahead, please.
Well, how does an average Joe like myself, I want to be involved in this political thing for the presidency. I'm a 50-year-old father of 4. One daughter's a cancer heart patient that's getting over to cancer, sure.
What do you want to do?
I want to be involved in politics. Probably I can't be the president, but that's what I want to run for. And when I lose, I'll have enough people behind me to start a little consulting firm. I live near D.C.
So you want to figure out how to run for president? Plan. How can
yeah,
how can
write-in candidate? Something.
How can Joe run for president, Larry?
Well, he can file. I wouldn't recommend it. It would be a waste of his money and time. Why not start out running for the city council or the county council, something like that? Work your way up. You know, experience matters. Look at the White House today.
Larry Sabato, Jenna Portner, Danielle Gaines, Martin Ostermuhl, thank you all for joining us. Tom Sherwood, any big plans this weekend?
No, I'm just here at home.
That's what we all are doing at this point. Thank you all for joining us. Today's show was produced by Sydney Grannon. Coming up Monday, Dr. Lena Nguyen returns to answer all your coronavirus questions. Plus, Bill Nye, the science guy, joins us for the latest Kojo for Kids, our weekly show just for young listeners. Ask him about comets, planets, genetics, mechanics. But sorry, adults, we're taking questions from kids only. That all starts on Monday at noon. Until then, thank you for listening. Stay safe and have a good weekend. I'm Kojo Nam.
Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sydney Grannon, Lauren Marco, Kurt Gardner, Richard Cunningham, and Kayla Hewitt. Our managing producer is Mana Kashvi. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.